This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Bonnie Toth, the Nevada Department of Education's Early Childhood Educator of the Year for 2022 and Director of the Kids Co-op Preschool. The nonprofit Early Childhood Education Facility is celebrating 40 years of creating a community where kids play to learn and learn through play. And registration's opening soon for the 2024-25 school year. Bonnie, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, what sets the Kids Co-op Preschool apart from other preschools in the Valley?
Well, two main things. The first is our operating structure, which is a cooperative. We are the only preschool cooperative in all of Nevada. We do partner with cooperatives in California. And we have just a lovely community here. So it's not just about children learning. It's also about parents learning. It's about families growing together. And the really unique thing that I love about being the director here is that I get to really know all of the families and the children. I know their situations. And we build this beautiful space together for children to grow and for parents to grow, and even for us as teachers to grow and learn together. The other thing that makes us really unique is our play philosophy. So when you walk into our classrooms, you won't see kiddos sitting down doing worksheets. They're up, they're learning, they're using their whole bodies. We look at the entire child. So we look at their social emotional development, their gross and fine motor development, as well as their cognitive development. And I love that because I feel like when children leave here, they are just really, really prepared for kindergarten in a way that you might not be coming from other programs. I also speak from personal experience because my three children are alum of the Kids Co-op, and I have just seen them blossom using the skills that I definitely attribute to them learning here.
Nice. Okay. So what exactly do you mean by a co-op when we're talking about education?
Oh, yeah. So we are a nonprofit, but we also are run by parents. So the school is owned by the parents that are here. So just like REI is a co-op, it's owned by the people who buy into it. That's our business structure. So when parents join here, they're investing in the school, and then they also help run the school. So our parents are our board of directors, and they run every aspect of the school from, you know, voting to figure out which air conditioning unit we're going to buy, to helping with the hiring when we have to hire a new teacher. They're intricately involved in every aspect of the school.
Okay, so how does this type of co-op structure benefit both parents and students?
So it benefits students because their parents or their caregivers, we have parents, grandparents, uncles, nannies, their caregivers are in their space. And there's something so unique about watching a child teach their parent about whatever it is that they're learning in school. So their caregivers will volunteer in the classroom 1 to 2 times a month. And so when they come in and their child's just so excited to, you know, say, look at the cutting that I'm working on. I learned how to write my name. And there's just such a richness to see that. The other thing that they benefit from is having interactions with a lot of different adults. So I feel like when children leave here, they have the capability to talk to adults in a way that I don't see a lot of young children have because they work with so many different adults. So they're able to state what they need in polite ways, but that also get across what they need. So I think the social emotional aspect of it is really important for kids. For parents, I think that the best thing I ever did as a parent was to be a parent at the co-op because I got to see what other parents were doing. I got to learn in a place that was non-judgmental and where other people were also like working with the same things that I'm working with. And then I got to make connections with other people in my community. And I think that that's one of the things about Las Vegas is because we're such a transient town, parents can struggle finding their tribe or their group of people. And when they're here, they get to work with other parents. They get to play with other parents and they get to know those parents' kids too, which is just really special. So when my child is talking about her best friend, I know exactly who she's talking about. I know that child's parent because I've worked with them. And it just allows for those connections to be very rich. And my children still have best friends from the co-op. And my oldest now is a sophomore in high school.
Wow. And that brings up a good point. The kids' co-op preschool has been around for 40 years now. Why was it originally established?
So it was originally established by a group of parents who wanted a different type of preschool experience for their children. They didn't see anything like this here in Las Vegas. Those group of parents actually applied to the Junior League and got a $200 grant, and they started in one of the parents' garage. And then over the years, the co-op rented out space throughout the valley. And oh gosh, when was it? We moved into our own space in this building about 18 years ago. And so since then, we've just been a staple over here in the neighborhood. And it's been so lovely to have our own space. We just continue to grow and offer more classes. But the main premise of parent involvement has always been a huge part of what we do.
Nice. Okay. So where is it located now?
We are located at 4316 North Decatur. So it's on the corner of Decatur and Craig.
Okay. Now, what does it mean that kids are playing to learn and learning through play?
Oh, good question. So when we look at how people learn, they learn by connecting things to previous knowledge. So the most effective way for children to learn and for anybody to learn really is when you're engaged and you're having fun because it allows for so many different brain connections to have. So if I'm just looking at a worksheet, I'm only engaging a single part of my brain, maybe two if I'm writing on it. But if I'm doing that same work, so let's say I'm learning the letter A, but now I'm using my fingers and I'm tracing the letter A in a tray of sand. And then we're writing the letter A out on the wall. So I'm using like my whole body. I'm making multiple connections with what that letter means with my body, with my hands, with we eat things that start with the ah sound. So we're engaging all of our senses. And so there's so many different ways for a kid's brain to make a connection with what that is. So the learning becomes very deep and very rich. And it also allows for an environment where we can meet the needs of multiple children better. Because in that play environment, I can easily pull out, like, I know this child loves dinosaurs. So I can play dinosaurs with them in a way that introduces all of the cognitive skills that I want them to learn, but in a way that's engaging to them that they want to continue playing. So I can dive deeper into the learning because it's something that they're already interested in.
Okay. What ages are the kids that you accept at the facility?
We start at 2, and our oldest group of kids is pre-K. So they're generally speaking 4 when they enter their pre-K year, and then 5 when they leave their pre-K year. And then most children leave here and go to kindergarten.
Okay, awesome. So when does registration open for the 2024-25 school year?
So our open registration begins February 28th for next year. And if folks are interested in learning more about it, they can visit our website at www.kidscoop.org. And we have all of our registration paperwork on there. And then we also have some information on there. Our big fundraiser is coming up. It's a silent auction and gala. And we already actually have it up and running. And we have some great items on there, including, which I'm so excited about, a signed jersey by the whole VGK team. So we have a lot going on our website if people are interested in learning more about us.
Nice. Okay. And when exactly does the fundraiser take place?
So the online portion of our silent auction, it just became live yesterday, and we'll continue to add items to that throughout the next couple of months. And then our actual auction, we're going to be holding at the Discovery Children's Museum, and that's going to be on April 27th. And that's our big auction gala. It's our big fundraiser of the year.
Awesome. Okay. So you said that registration opens for next year on February 28th, and when does it close?
We remain in open registration, and then once the classes are full, then we continue to put children on a wait list also because we are a transient town, people do, they leave for various reasons, a lot of military people, and we continue open registration through. However, we are offering tours right now. So a lot of people like to come and take a tour of the facility. We really encourage you to bring your child when you come to tour the facility and let them play and see them in the space, because it's really fun to see what children do when they walk into a space that's specifically designed for them. So we're open for tours right now.
Perfect. Okay. So you gave the website, but let's say it again, where people can go to find out more information, or I guess book a tour of the preschool or take part in the silent auction that is currently happening right now online.
Yes. So it's www.kidscoop.org. So KIDSCOOP.org.
Okay, perfect. So once again, kidscoop.org is the website to go to, kidscoop.org. You can find out more about the Kids Co-op Preschool. You can book a tour of the preschool, bring your kids along. And if you're looking for registration for the 2024-25 school year, it opens on February 28th, but you can take a tour before that. It's located at Decatur and Craig. And of course, their fundraiser is happening right now. The silent auction is online, it's live. And then their gala fundraiser is happening April 27th at Children's Discovery Museum. And again, you can get all of that information at the website kidscoop.org, KIDSCOOP.org. And we've been speaking with Bonnie Toth. She's the director of the Kids Co-op Preschool. And Bonnie, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know about this fantastic preschool that I think a lot of people have not heard of, because I know that I've never heard of it before, even
Yeah.
being around 40 years. It must be a hidden jewel.
Absolutely is.
So I really appreciate you being here and sharing it with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
When a student lacks some of the most basic needs,
like food, clothing, and school supplies,
it can be challenging to even attend school.
It can be hard to study, tough to concentrate, impossible to thrive.
At Communities in Schools, we address this issue every day.
Out in the community, there are great resources for students, and we bring these resources directly to the students who need them most.
We work to ensure that they have everything they need to re-engage in learning in the classroom and at home,
including access to technology, learning materials,
and even emotional support.
By forging caring relationships with students and bringing communities of support to them,
our staff works to achieve equitable learning conditions so all kids can succeed in school and in life. And that's what Communities in Schools is all about.
To learn more, visit communitiesinschools.org.
You're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Dr. Stephanie Fuller, attending surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. February is American Heart Month, and some new innovations are making a difference for babies born with congenital heart disease. Dr. Fuller, thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks so much for having me, Heather.
So, how many babies each year are born with congenital heart disease?
Congenital heart defects are actually the most common birth defect worldwide. So, we have about 1 in 120 babies born with heart disease each year. And in the U.S., that adds up to about 40,000 babies every year.
And what exactly causes it?
It's a really good question. We do not know. And although there are some genetic associations with some forms of cardiac disease, most of it is actually quite spontaneous. So it's a little hard to predict who is going to develop congenital heart disease.
Okay. So how are heart defects diagnosed and then treated?
Well, it depends on the type of heart disease. But nowadays, thanks to advancement in imaging and prenatal care, most forms of congenital heart disease are actually diagnosed in utero. So usually an anatomy scan around 16 weeks of age might tip off an OBGYN that there's something unusual. Patients who have a family history, for example, might undergo an anatomy scan and a dedicated echocardiogram or ultrasound of the heart while they're in utero. So we can pick up a lot of forms of heart disease as early as about 16 weeks, for example.
Okay, and if a baby is diagnosed in utero as having a heart defect or heart disease, what can be done at that point to treat it?
So realistically, we don't have a lot of treatments or therapies available while babies are in utero. But what it does is it gives us a huge head start in terms of how we're going to treat heart disease once a baby is born. So there's a wide spectrum of congenital heart disease. We're able to basically tell what the severity is. And about 25% of babies who are born with congenital heart disease have a critical form. So that's a form that needs an intervention during the first year of life. And I think from the perspective of being a care team, physicians, surgeons who are managing these patients, it really helps us to prepare parents so they know exactly what to expect when they're going to have a baby born with congenital heart disease.
Okay, so what are some of the options available to parents when it comes to treatment and interventions?
So we kind of break those down in terms of what type of heart disease it is and then what type of treatment is best suited for that form of heart disease. So some of the treatments, for example, will never come to surgery. It's all going to be medical management. These are patients, for example, who have abnormal heart rhythms that require management. Some patients are treated by catheter-based interventions, so it's a procedure, but it doesn't involve open heart surgery. And the most severe forms actually require an operation using the bypass machine in order to try and correct a lesion. Oftentimes, these lesions are what we call palliated, meaning that they have a treatment that's going to help the heart to function better, but it's not actually a cure for congenital heart disease. So these patients do require follow-up over the course of a lifetime.
What does the future for treatment and interventions look like as opposed to how you might have treated it in the past?
Great question. So realistically, up until the 1980s, there were some forms of congenital heart disease that were completely 100% lethal. And now, even with those most severe forms of heart disease, with advancements in imaging and medical therapy and surgical techniques and ICU care and new medications that have been developed, more than 97% of children born with congenital heart disease are expected to reach adulthood. So realistically, depending on the type of treatment, for example, a hole in the heart can be patched. Babies born with half a heart can have their blood flow redirected so that they can efficiently pump blood to their body and still oxygenate their blood as it goes through their lungs. A variety of different treatments are available for these patients, and many of these have been groundbreaking surgeries.
Okay. How has artificial intelligence played into this process of detecting, diagnosing, and treating congenital heart disease?
Ah, that's a terrific question. So actually, we don't know the full extent of how AI is going to help us at this point. But there's been a lot of work looking at AI in terms of, can we improve the accuracy of diagnosis? Number one, is AI going to help us to look at images and be able to immediately give us a diagnosis in some cases where maybe the images aren't of great quality, for example? Another example is looking at data. You know, we track all our data. So the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, basically every hospital in the country, I believe almost 99% of them report their data to the Society of Thoracic Surgeons so we can look at outcomes and we can compare outcomes and we have what is going to be an expected outcome. And looking at big data, now we can merge not only the surgical data, but with ICU care data. We can use AI in our intensive care unit to help identify and predict when a patient's in trouble, when we should be concerned that vital signs are trending towards potentially having an issue, for example, a cardiac arrest, long before we're able to pick it up otherwise. There's subtle changes in patients' biometrics and in their vital signs and in their feeding patterns, for example, might be tips that, you know, we can anticipate are going to help us better anticipate when a patient can have an issue. So I think AI is really going to come into play significantly in the world of managing congenital heart disease.
Wow, that's fantastic. Okay, so where can our listeners go to get more information about congenital heart disease and advancements in treatments for kids?
Well, we have a terrific website here at Children's Hospital Philadelphia. It's very informative, and it informs patients and parents not only about specific types of lesions, but also kind of general approaches to care, and then also a lot of information about what's going to happen later in life. The website is chop.edu/heart.
Okay, Perfect. So chop.edu/heart is the website to go to. CHOP stands for Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, chop.edu/heart. And you can find out plenty of information there about the advancements in treating congenital heart disease. We've been speaking with Dr. Stephanie Fuller. She's the attending surgeon at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. And Dr. Fuller, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know for American Heart Month what some of the advancements are when it comes to kids. So I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Don't you wish your life came with a warning app?
Stop. That dog does not want to be petted.
Just a little heads up before something bad happens.
Move your coffee cup away from your computer.
Oh, no, 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 no.
So you can have more control.
Stop. You're texting your boss by mistake.
Uh-oh. Well, life doesn't always give you time to change the outcome, but prediabetes does. With early diagnosis and a few healthy changes like managing your weight, getting active, stopping smoking, and eating healthier, you can stop prediabetes before it leads to type 2 diabetes. It's easy to learn your risk. Take the 1-minute test today at doihaveprediabetes.org.
Warning, the cap is loose on that ketchup.
Ugh. Don't wait. You have the power to change the outcome. Visit doihaveprediabetes.org today. That's doihaveprediabetes.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council and its Prediabetes Awareness Partners.
I'm Heather Vail, and you're listening to the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. Joining me is Kay Hayes, Director of the Office of Infectious Disease and HIV/AIDS Policy, and Alicia Diggs, member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. February is the month for National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness, so we're looking at how HIV disproportionately impacts Black communities, and especially Black women. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Thank you.
So why does HIV disproportionately impact Black communities?
When you look at the statistics in the Black community, and we're looking at the CDC data, which is the latest of 2021, Black people represented only 13% of the population, but accounted for nearly 40% of new diagnoses, and then half of the diagnoses are in the South. I think when we start looking at communities not utilizing all the prevention tools, medicine, in a sense, we really have to use all of our tools, and then we can't really impact if we're not talking about sort of that pandemic approach.
Okay, and then why are Black women specifically hit the hardest?
When I think about how Black women are disproportionately impacted by HIV, one of the number one keys comes to mind is stigma, domination and discrimination, internalized stigma, which is the shame of discrimination caused by a person who feels isolated and feels like they are not able to seek help. And then we even talk about structural stigma, which is the laws, the policies, and practices which result in the unfair treatment of people living with HIV or affected by HIV. And it's so much discrimination when it comes to HIV being imposed by our community. It's also because of lack of services, lack of education, lack of support, and people, again, feeling isolated. And some women have homes and family responsibilities that prevent them from focusing on themselves.
Okay, so the issue is more of a lack of access to prevention and treatment rather than a biological predisposition to the disease, or is it a combination of both?
No, we really have to focus on getting Black women tested, access to prevention tools, access to HIV medicine. I want to say at HHS, we have an I Am the Work of Art campaign, which really features a diverse group of people with HIV, including members of the Black and African American community. But really, that's a life-saving because it makes sense if we're trying to get women, people virally suppressed. And what I mean by that is that we're just helping people live healthier lives. And so there are tools that we need to make sure that when Alicia talks about what's happening in communities, that Black women have access to all the tools, prevention tools, and then HIV medication. So it's a combination, not a predisposition being predisposed, but really the factors that are life factors in community.
Yeah, okay. So what are some of the tests and prevention tools that would help solve the problem?
Well, one tool that I mentioned is that I Am a Work of Art campaign. And basically this campaign, we have persons that share their experiences of getting into HIV care and starting therapy and really maintaining viral suppression. And that is key because that way people can live longer and healthier lives. So that's key. That's one tool, one resource there.
And what exactly is viral suppression?
Viral suppression is basically when there is so little detection of the virus in your system that you're not able to pass the virus on to anyone. So we talk about U equals U, undetectable equals untransmittable. And that is the key. That is a game changer in the work that we do.
Nice. Okay. So where can our listeners go if they'd like to get more information?
Oh, absolutely. So we have incredible resources. I want to say sort of a call to action and look to our HIV.gov for resources. We also have information on I Am a Work of Art, the campaign. And then I just want to say that there are resources from a lot of our partners across the country that are doing incredible work in communities. And so I always want to say, look into local communities like, you know, there in Clark County to see those local resources that are tapping into the national as well. But a great place to start, HIV.gov.
Okay, perfect. So HIV.gov is the website to go to, HIV.gov. Plenty of information there on HIV/AIDS and National Black HIV/AIDS Awareness, as well as look into local resources. We have plenty here, but perfect starting point, again, HIV.gov. We've been speaking with Kay Hayes. She's the director of the Office of Infectious Disease and HIV/AIDS Policy, and also Alicia Diggs, who's a member of the Presidential Advisory Council on HIV/AIDS. And I want to thank you both so much for being here and bringing awareness to this situation, as well as some of the possible solutions. So I appreciate you both. Thank you so much.
No, thank you. And thank you for taking the time to help us spread this message.
My pain into purpose is pretty much what I have done to start this foundation.
In August 2020, after the death of George Floyd, Bridget Floyd and other family members established the George Floyd Memorial Foundation in support of the Black community.
It's going to take more than just us as a foundation. It's going to take the community, the world, to make a change.
Fight for racial justice for the Black community. Learn how at lovehasnolabels.com. Brought to you by Love Has No Labels and the Ad Council.
This is the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show. I'm Heather Vail, and I'm speaking with Carly Ruskowski, VP of Financial Resilience Programming at AARP. AARP is the nation's largest nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that empowers people 50 and older to choose how they live as they age. And they have some advice for older workers looking to get hired in 2024. Carly, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me.
So what advice can you offer someone who's older and trying to get a job this year?
So many older workers do feel that age discrimination can hurt them in getting a new job or advancing in their career. New AARP research shows that 64% of workers 50 plus believe that they face age discrimination in the workplace today. So we want to make sure that older workers' resume highlights their skills, not their age. Generally speaking, their resume should be no more than 2 pages long and should really focus on their most recent and relevant experience. While you want to include your credentials, you don't need to include your graduation dates. Don't include your street address. Including that full mailing address is an outdated practice. And if you're still holding on to that old AOL or Hotmail email account, upgrade it to a more modern account like Gmail. Also, best practice for older job seekers and job seekers of all ages is to bot-proof your resume. These AI-based tools that organizations use, also known as bots, do this initial review or scan to eliminate candidates before they're seen by an actual human being. So to improve your chances of making it past those digital gatekeepers or that initial review, make sure that your resume includes industry-specific terms, but also specific keywords from the job listings that you're interested in.
Okay, that's some good advice that I was not aware. I did not know about these bots. All right. So we know how to make our resume more age-proof. But once we have that tool, what does a job search landscape look like these days for older Americans?
So while we did see the labor market cool over the last couple months, it's still very strong and unemployment is at historic lows. Earlier this year, we did survey people 50 and older, asking them if they were planning to make a job change this year, and about 14% said yes. So making more money was the top reason, followed closely by wanting to feel valued and wanting more flexible work options. And encouragingly, 86% of them did feel confident that they could make the shift in this calendar year.
Okay. Now, we always have this preconceived notion that employers are specifically looking for younger workers, people fresh out of college, maybe people in their 20s and early 30s. What companies are actually looking to hire older workers?
Yeah, a lot of interest has increased over the years. Here at AARP, we have an initiative called our Employer Pledge Program that recognizes the value of experienced workers. And we have organizations of all sizes that are committed to an age-diverse workforce to sign the pledge. And over 3,000 companies since 2012 have signed our pledge, with almost 500 organizations joining in 2023 alone. So given the employer's need for talent, especially in this tight labor market, it does make great business sense to hire experienced workers. Research shows that having a diverse, multi-generational workforce can improve the bottom line. And research shows that 77% of all workers say that they value their older colleagues for the skills and experience that they bring to the job.
Nice. Okay. So how do we find those employers that have taken the employer pledge?
At aarp.org/work, you can find our AARP job board, where you can not only look for jobs, but you can find job postings from employer pledge signers within that job board.
Nice. Okay. And then what about networking? How important is it if you're looking for a job?
Networking is critical to the job search, and experienced workers have a wealth of colleagues, former colleagues that they can talk to, neighbors, loved ones, and let them know that they're looking for new job opportunities and get their suggestions and their advice. Also, if you're not on LinkedIn, now's a great time to join. In order for employers to find you and make your page stand out, make sure you include your profile photo as well as fill out the skills section. LinkedIn members with 5 skills listed are 27 times more likely to be discovered by recruiters. LinkedIn also provides groups that you can join, and they offer great networking opportunities both virtually and in person.
Okay, now I've started to see more lately about scammers using LinkedIn to post fake job opportunities. How do we determine whether it's a true opportunity or just a trap?
Well, AARP is offering free workshops throughout the month of February, and these workshops will focus on how to update and age-proof your resume, use your networking skills, honing your interviewing skills, but also how to avoid these work-from-home scams or job scams. You can register for a day or time that works best for your schedule at aarp.org/jobsnational.
Okay, perfect. And I know AARP always has a ton of free resources. So you've mentioned 2 great pages on the aarp.org site. What other free resources does AARP offer to older Americans looking for work?
Yes, I mentioned our job board, but we also help with resumes. We have a Skills Builder for Work platform that offers hundreds of courses to upskill or reskill on topics from digital marketing to starting your own business. And all of those resources can be found at aarp.org/work.
Okay, nice. So aarp.org/work is the website to go to if you want to access the job board. Those are employers who are part of the Employer Pledge Network who have pledged to hire older Americans, or at least look at older Americans who are applying for jobs. aarp.org/work. And you can also find help with resumes. You can find Skills Builder courses there. And then if you want to take one of the free workshops, you can check out a day or time that works for you. That's at aarp.org/jobsnational, aarp.org/jobsnational. Jobs National. And we've been speaking with Carly Roskowski. She's the VP of Financial Resilience Programming at AARP. And Carly, I want to thank you so much for being here and letting us know more about what resources are out there and some great tips for older Americans who are looking for work in 2024. So thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Retirement can be scary, but only if you're not prepared. That's why AARP created thisispretirement.org. Because unless you've already retired, you're in pretirement and you still have time to plan. Learn about retirement savings options, potential tax breaks, and how you can build savings over time. Visit thisispretirement.org for free resources to help you customize your action plan and feel the retirement fear disappear. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
From Odyssey, this is Odyssey Conversations. Today, we take you to the Odyssey Soundspace in Los Angeles as KNX news anchors Charles Feldman and Mike Simpson discuss the state of the entertainment industry and how streaming is affecting the creative community and content they produce.
Hollywood's always reflected the changing world around it. Culture, sensibilities, technology.
But we are clearly at an inflection point, coming off a very historic half-year strike, with streaming services rising and old business models falling. So what does the future of the entertainment industry actually look like? And what does this mean for what we all will see on the screen?
Well, that's what we're talking about. We brought together a group of people who are making, distributing, and covering the content. Ron Perlman, veteran actor, writer, producer, might know him as Hellboy, or one of the dozens of characters he's portrayed over the years. Ron, also the founder and director of Wing and a Prayer Studio. Cynthia Littleton, co-editor-in-chief of Variety, which has been covering the news of Hollywood for nearly 120 years. Karina Manishill, president of Mad Solar Productions, company on the leading edge of the film business, creative force behind movies like X and Pearl. We have Patrick Gomez, editor-in-chief, general manager of Entertainment Weekly, one of the most widely read sources in the country on the industry, and Duncan Crabtree Ireland, national executive director, chief negotiator for SAG-AFTRA, union representing 160,000 actors, broadcast journalists, recording artists, and performers.
Now, at the end of the show, we are going to take some questions from our studio audience, but we're going to start by, this is not a scientific poll by any means, but we're going to take a quick sample of what you folks think the state of the entertainment industry is now. So what I want to do is I'm going to ask you a question and just shout it out. If you think that the entertainment industry is doing just fine, shout out a good, really heartfelt yes. Wow, we're in trouble. And those of you who think that it's not doing so fine, a no?
No.
Ron Perlman, like they say, showbiz is your life. What do you think?
I'm with you guys.
Which one? The nose.
I'm in a state of constant mourning over the state of the entertainment industry because of how unrecognizable it is to the power and the glory and the effect that it's had on my thinking about the humanities.
But Ron, do you think that there's any hope for it? I mean, you have a very pessimistic view on it. But
no, I'm incredibly optimistic.
You are.
I just hate the people who are running the show right now. The art form of cinema and television, I guess, is an offshoot of it, was invented by family-run businesses, studios. And the competition and the lust for profits were every bit as real as they are now, but their version of competing with each other was to make better stuff than the next guy did and make sure that it got to the audience as good as it possibly could. So there was a pride of ownership that comes with a mom and pop sort of a business that is completely removed when it's corporate run and corporations started taking over the movie business, the studios, and then the TV studios. When I guess I'm not a historian, but around the 50s, the studios started to falter. Gulf Western comes in, Sony comes in, Seagram's comes in, you know, and our entertainment, which was an offshoot of the desire to blow people's minds about being part of a collective consciousness, which is what culture is meant to do, turned into the desire to compete for stock prices. What was always an uneasy relationship between management and labor, the gap right now is the people who are in charge of when the work finally comes down to those of us who do it, have zero in common with us, zero. And as long as that is just, I sound pessimistic, but those of us who do it love it more than ever, and we will prevail when we kill the model that's currently in place.
Duncan Crabtree, Ireland, SAG-AFTRA, where are we now post-strike, given, you know, the thoughts of the audience and the thoughts of Ron here?
Yeah, no, I mean, hearing what Ron said and also with what the audience says, I think last year reflects that, right? Like, what happened last year reflected the fact that there was a feeling among certainly the members of SAG-AFTRA, exemplified by Ron and many others, who not only, you know, supported the idea of a strike, but actually got out there, were on picket lines, were at rallies, were doing things, not just saying things, but doing things to try and help change the business, to help move it in the right direction, to move it in a direction that is less, you know, perhaps about the audience of one, more about the collective consciousness that Ron was talking about, more about making sure that artists have control and that creativity remains in the hands of humans. I mean, this was the kind of thing that people were fighting for. And so there is, I think, a reason to be optimistic.
Cynthia Littleton, who's the co-editor-in-chief of Variety. Variety, as we mentioned, has been covering showbiz for 120 years. You haven't.
1905. But that is, in fact, the year I started.
Okay. So Variety has seen, obviously, lots of changes in Hollywood. Where would you say the state of the business is now?
I will say that, just forgive me for plugging the home team, but Variety, one of the most enlightening things that I did during the strike was to go back and look in our pages and look at 1960, the last time that the Writers Guild of America and SAG-AFTRA were on strike together. And then I went back to 1980 and looked at the last time and the coverage, and it was so eye-opening. The patterns, the parallels, what was different, what was not. And that is, that benefit of hindsight really is helpful. I think in any conversation about a golden age, or is it, you know, is it over, is it ending, it's, I think, to understand what happened last year, you have to understand the context of how not only has television changed, viewers can tell that television has changed, the rise of Netflix and Hulu and other streaming services, the ability for people to, what we call, 10 years ago we called it time shifting, the ability for people to watch any show. You no longer have to show up Thursday at 9 to watch your favorite show. You can watch it at any time. That had ripple effects. It changed consumer behavior to a degree that forced Hollywood would have much preferred the old system. They made more money, they had more control, but technology really did put so much in the hands of viewers. Behind the scenes, for actors like Ron, for writers, there was so much change in the way television and movies were produced. The nature of the way people worked changed so much, so quickly. It's actually almost an embarrassment that it took a strike to bring all of that. It took a historic dual strike to bring all of that in perspective. We could see those changes in the moment, but the cumulative effect of industry, I mean, transition doesn't begin to describe what has gone on in Hollywood in this past decade and is going to continue into the, you know, certainly into this, well into this decade. There is a shaking out of corporate interests, and I'm sorry to say, but I think that in Hollywood, I think you're only going to see more consolidation in the coming years, and that is going to be challenging for individuals and unions. But I think to appreciate what we've been through, you have to understand, really have to understand just how much things have changed behind the scenes and what pressure it put on working Hollywood. And so going forward, you know, we're coming out of an age of 600 scripted television series, you know, one for almost two for every day of the week. That was, although it was a bonanza of work, that was a bubble that was unsustainable. And when it eventually burst, it really burst. So there is so much to unpack. But I just want to say that also, I mean, at a moment when you can have things like a movie like Barbie, a television show that is distinctive as a show like Atlanta, you have a time when the what's possible in content is awe-inspiring, It's just a matter of getting to how people distribute, how they make money. That is the big challenge. That is the actors and writers made incredible strides, but the larger picture of how that monetization happens and compared to the old world where they make, you know, where they just made sacks of money, now they're, you know, now they're not making quite as much money. That is something that is gonna we're still in that messy middle of figuring
Karina
out.
Karina at Mad Solar Productions, seen you nodding along to our panels. They've been talking and some smiles. And I think some are like sad smiles at some of the stuff that's going on. But give me that sliding scale of the difficulty for getting the projects off the ground, the stories that you want to tell in this era that we're in.
It's a great question. I will say, listening to Ron, the idea of content made to entertain and a collective consciousness coming together to enjoy something sounds so romantic, which is the thing that leans into sad. The fact that you almost can't even imagine what would it be like to watch something and collectively all of us have seen it at the same time and want to talk about it together. The amount of programming is so vast, which is exciting in the sense that there's something for everybody, but I do feel like it's a very fragmenting experience when you consider how art is ideally meant to bring us together, to give us something to share. None of us are wrong in what we're pursuing, but because we're not doing it together, there's something that we're all sort of missing tangibly that has traditionally come from this form of entertainment. I would say that in terms of the way that I look at the business and what's happened, in addition to the strikes last year, I found that one of the most significant moments was that Netflix subscriber drop, because what happened was this reflective turn that if, oh, the bubble is bursting, this can't continue the way that it's going. And every other streamer, whether they were starting to see their stock prices drop or not, started to react with, oops, let's go broad and safe. Let's go as four quadrant, easy, inexpensive. Let's not take those risks, because if it's happening to Netflix, it can happen to us too, and we don't want to be next on that totem pole. In the same breath, the financiers traditionally who do more interesting or innovative stuff and then will lay it off to a buyer reacted the same way. Hang on a sec, money's harder to come by. Cost plus model is not paying us what it used to be. What are we going to do except for things that we really believe are going to sell in a broad marketplace to a broad in buyer interest. So everything, I think, has dropped. Well, I guess pendulum has swung to this drop in content production that I don't think is particularly interesting, but I do believe the pendulum always swings back and forth. I think that things are constantly in flux and constantly changing, even over the course of my time, even from that moment of House of Cards and True Detective at the same time where, oh, I can binge TV and Matthew McConaughey is nominated for an Oscar and an Emmy in the same year, so you can pitch any piece of talent for television. There was such a significant shift there, and I do believe that things will continue to ebb back and forth, but My outlook, at least in my company, which is very culture facing, and that's where, you know, partnered with Kid Cudi's and a constant dialogue with the kids, it's a very lives in that frame of mind. My reaction has been, well, if what are the kids paying attention to? They're gaming, they're reading comic books, they're watching animated programs, they're listening to music,
they
they're buying fashion.
YouTube right?
More than anything else. I mean, I feel like on the artist spectrum, not to say that all artists need to diversify, because it's not an organic thing to ask, but at least for us, the reaction has been, you know, play in different horizontals, because you're not then so beholden to the whims of the pendulum in our business.
Patrick Gomez, last but not least, editor-in-chief and general manager of Entertainment Weekly. So we heard Karina talking about the pendulum swinging back and forth. Where, in your view, is that pendulum now?
I mean, I think it's like going around in a circle, like a clock moving too fast. You know, as it was mentioned, we're in a state of flux right now. And to go back to a little bit of what Ron was saying, and also what we were talking about, the history, and when you look at the past strikes, the important thing to also is to take a step back and say, if you're not in the entertainment industry, if you work in, if you have a small business, you're going through a similar thing. You're watching all these consolidations and these conglomerates come in and take over and consolidate businesses. And you're missing the artistry and artisanship that went into making a piece of furniture from scratch, and it's all, you know, manufactured overseas. We're seeing this throughout our industries. It's not just entertainment. And so it's if you're not in the entertainment industry and you're looking for parallels, they're there, unfortunately, everywhere right now. And then not only to look back at former strikes, but I would look at the music industry, and they went through a whole reckoning of how do we grapple with technology coming in and changing our industry so rapidly. But they did take a minute and they figured out a way to at least be sustainable with the streaming platforms that are more legit and that you're actually able to be paid for your content. I think the other thing that was mentioned was YouTube and social media, and Gen Z and younger are looking at they're going to TikTok to type in, how do I cut bangs? How do I cook an omelet? They're not going to Google or even YouTube like some of us that are not that young. They're going to TikTok for those things. So the platforms are changing. And what's really cool about that is that there's a democratization of access to audience.
All right, that's all we have time for. A big thank you to our panelists for taking time out of a very busy award season schedule to be here for a very important conversation.
For the full show and more stories like this one, download the free Odyssey app and search KNX News or go to knxnews.com/townhall.
Only 1 in 5 people with disabilities, including those with autism, are employed, despite many having the skill set and desire to work.
Maybe it's because employers don't know what kind of jobs they can do.
Okay, try me.
What about a programmer?
That is a job for someone with autism.
What about a teacher?
That is a job for someone with autism.
Oh, how about a healthcare worker?
Yes, those are all jobs for someone with autism. The truth is, qualified people with autism can do a lot of different jobs, but often get overlooked due to outdated stigmas and beliefs. Businesses value diversity, but sometimes don't recognize the unique strengths and abilities of the autism community. Introducing WIN, the Workplace Inclusion Now program by Autism Speaks. We help businesses lead the way in inclusive hiring.
Ooh, what about a ranch hand?
Yeah!
Sure, that's a job for someone with autism too. To learn more, go to autismspeaks.org/win. That's autismspeaks.org/win.
I'm Heather Vail with the Odyssey Las Vegas Public Affairs Show, and this is your community events calendar for nonprofit initiatives and charity events around the Valley. February is Black History Month, and the Las Vegas Natural History Museum is celebrating with a new exhibit called Resilience through Thursday, February 29th, and they're open daily from 9 a.m. to 4 p.m. Resilience is a community-created cultural exhibition and museum-created historical exploration of scientific contributions from influential African Americans. Find out more or get tickets at lvnhm.org. That stands for Las Vegas Natural History Museum, lvnhm.org. February is also National Library Lovers Month, and the Las Vegas Clark County Library District is celebrating with their annual Library Lovers Month giveaway. Pick up your free Vegas Golden Knights player bookmarks at any branch of the Las Vegas Clark County Library District. Then use your library card number to enter for a chance to win a pair of Vegas Golden Knights tickets or an exclusive VGK 2023 World Champions t-shirt. You can get a free library card at any of the 25 neighborhood branches or online at thelibrarydistrict.org. That's thelibrarydistrict.org. Monday's Dark with Mark Chinook is a bi-monthly musical fundraising party at The Space, with each event raising $10,000 for a specific charity in 90 minutes. Upcoming shows include this Monday, February 19th at 8 p.m. benefiting CORE, and Monday, March 4th at 8 p.m. benefiting Living Grace Homes. Get tickets or find out more details at mondaysdark.com. That's mondaysdark.com. The inaugural Micro Business Summit to help small business owners with fewer than 10 employees and future entrepreneurs is happening next Saturday, February 24th from 9 a.m. to 1 p.m. at Las Vegas City Hall. This event is sponsored by GoDaddy, the City of Las Vegas, Workforce Connections, and Bank of Nevada, and it's free to attend for entrepreneurs, but registration is required. Find out more information or register to attend at workforceconnections.org. That's workforceconnections.org. February is National Heart Month, and the Children's Heart Foundation, along with Clark County Commissioners, invite you to a special sign lighting and ceremony at the Welcome to Fabulous Las Vegas sign on Tuesday, February 27th at 2 p.m. Show love to the Heart Kids as Vegas goes red for Heart Month by turning the iconic sign lights red for the day. That's Tuesday, February 27th at 2 p.m. Registration for the 2024-25 school year of the nonprofit Kids Co-op Preschool opens February 28th and continues until classes are full. Book a tour of the facilities or find out more information at kidscoop.org. That's kids, C-O-O-P, kidscoop.org. The 6th Annual Walk for Friendship Las Vegas Fundraiser, Walk, and Community Carnival is happening Sunday, April 7th, with check-in at 10 a.m., walk at 11 a.m., and carnival at noon at Las Vegas Sports Park, 14 North Rampart Boulevard. Support the Friendship Circle's efforts to provide social and recreational opportunities for children and young adults with disabilities. Find out more or register at walkforfriendshiplv.com. That's the number 4, walkforfriendshiplv.com. And Make-A-Wish Southern Nevada is holding their 22nd annual Walk for Wishes fundraising event on World Wish Day, Saturday, April 27th, with 8 a.m. registration and the walk and run starting at 8:30 at Town Square, Las Vegas. Make-A-Wish chapters and affiliates across the globe come together each year to celebrate World Wish Day, the anniversary of the wish that inspired the founding of Make-A-Wish back in 1980. You can join in the celebration of more than 550,000 wishes that have already been granted while raising funds for future wishes. Sign up or find out more information at wish.org/snv/walk. That's wish.org/snv/walk.